Here we go. Hello, all, and welcome to the Fantasy and Sci-Fi Fanatics podcast. I am your host, Daniel Kubal. Today, I have me a very special guest, G. Owen Wares. How are you doing today?
I am doing well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Well, I appreciate you coming on today. I know you've been in my podcast Facebook group for quite a while, so it always feels good to, to get people on here, who have been sharing quite a few products, things like that. So I've seen them quite a bit, which I love within the group. As the only moderator, I'm like, come on, guys, let's get going. I definitely feel I appreciate it. First of all, thank you. I feel like, you posting your content at that time in particular when you joined really helped other people feel more comfortable, because I was like having to beg people in a group, right? Like authors and creatives be like, please post your products. Like I never thought I'd have to do that. Like other groups are like, don't post on except for every other third Friday or something. And I'm like, just post it, guys. So I do appreciate that, because at that time in particular, it was like you and probably like six or seven other people that were in there who were really starting to post. And then after that, it really started like an upward trend where, I get anywhere from, 10 to 12 per day of like really good content being shared. So I just wanted to take a moment to, really thank you for joining the group and, for sharing your books. And I think people really enjoyed the covers. I know I did. Had quite a few conversations about the blurbs too. So that was really awesome. So thank you so much for posting that and just generating some interest in the group. So I definitely appreciate that. And thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, absolutely. It's nice to be a part of a group where you're encouraged to post, unlike the ones you mentioned, where every other Thursday before 3 p.m., not including full moons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
that drove me crazy.
7 to 10 Eastern Standard Time, or I had one that was like Australia time, and I'm like, that's like 2 a.m. I don't know. It was, yeah, it gets kind of crazy after a while. So I had somebody that sent me a Excel spreadsheet, an author, an indie author, and he said, don't worry, guys, I have a spreadsheet of the name of the groups when you can post. And I was looking at it, I was like, I just can't do this anymore. So my friend goes, why don't you start your own group? He goes, you have a podcast. I'm like, I do have a podcast. So that's why I was like, I'm just going to start one. So I appreciate that he showed me that, because it just showed me how ridiculous it is. I'm like, I don't know. I think it's kind of crazy. We're up to like 1500 people. I'm the only moderator, but I feel like other than the AI admin assist that is horrible, it's been pretty good so far, because I've collected a lot of people like yourself in there, who share a lot of great stuff. So I feel like it's definitely been a good move. So if anybody wants to join us, feel free. You can come see amazing books like yours, and get to see some cool products. So today we're talking about your writing journey and your books in particular. So what has your writing journey been like up until this point?
A little bit of a convoluted mess.
Amen to
So
that.
I started writing in 2011. I started with comic books. I was working for a we'll call them an online publisher. I won't drop their name because they treated me horribly and went out of business. But I was in the industry peripherally, got to go to San Diego Comic-Con for free, et cetera, et cetera. And thought I had a way just into comic books. So that was my focus. That all collapsed in 2014, and I went, well, crud. I had all these comic book scripts that were going nowhere. I had a falling out with an artist, so that killed another project. And I just went, you know what? Forget this. I am going to just do prose work because I'm the one in charge. And so all that summer of 2014, while I roasted in my apartment, I just after looking for a job in the morning, getting very, very depressed, I would just sit down in front of my laptop and write. And that's where my first novel, technically novella, it's kind of short, The Place of Stars and Bones came from. It was just me going by the seat of my pants and figuring out what this unnamed protagonist was doing. And he and I just sort of slogged through the phantasmagoric together. And then I spent years revising that book. So there's some old editions of that book out there that are very different from the new one that I
Interesting.
sell, because yeah, I went through several different iterations. After that, after I figured out how to put together a story, I started a anthology series called Exteris, not to be confused with the Xterra, which is a vehicle, or Xterras, which is a clothing line. That ran for 8 volumes. When I first started out, I didn't have enough contributors, so I wound up writing several pieces myself under pseudonyms,
Oh, cool.
some of which I will admit to, and some of which I won't. That taught me a lot of what not to do, a lot of what works, and out of that, I serialized several novels, one of which was Journeyman in Gray. I wrote that one under a pseudonym. That was the most popular one until my novel, The Pellucid Witch. Not a made-up word, by the way. Pellucid means clear and glass-like. I get accused of making up words for the title for that one, but no, I just did a deep dive into thesaurus.com. That one took over as the most popular, and just sort of snowballed after that.
That's interesting. When you were saying that, it makes me think when you were writing on different pseudonyms, I thought it was so funny because there's one of the Forgotten Realms authors from back in the day, and it like wasn't Ed Greenwood or Bob like R. Salvatore, but it was another one. It was like Mel Odom or who it was, but they actually wrote an entire anthology themselves of like 30 stories and came up with pseudonyms for every one of them. And I was like, oh, Mel's in this. And then there were like 29 other people. It was like whoever the author was. It was so funny because I was like, oh, these kind of sound familiar. And then I found out years and years later, because it was before everybody had the internet. I was like back in middle school. And then I found out, I think I was like way deep in like after college, like seven, probably 10 years ago. And I found out that they actually just wanted to write their own anthology and didn't want to invite anybody. So they just did them all themselves. So I thought that was absolutely like just the funniest idea. I think that's really interesting that you did there to, just to try and, like fill up and to get different stories out there. So that's really cool. I have to say though, I really love, I was just curious in terms of the place of Stars and Bones, is this like what iteration of covers is your current one? Because I absolutely love it. So I was just kind of curious when it popped up on my feed again recently. Is that a newer cover, or is that one that's been around for a while, or?
The answer is yes and yes. It is the newer cover. That's the one I decided to stick with.
That's cool.
So going forward, that's just going to be the cover. But it is a combination of the old cover with some new bits to it. The
Oh,
artist I
cool.
work with, Vladimir Rakowski, great guy, reasonable price. Look him up.
Oh,
That's
yeah, definitely.
Rakowski, I think. Yeah, he very kindly did that character, the nameless hero there, to go over the background he had done for the old cover. So it's sort of a mashup between the two. But
Oh, that's cool.
it's funny that you mentioned Mel Odom. I actually was in contact with him a few years ago because I believe it's the same guy, I think, who did all those illustrations way back in the day for like Blue Boy magazine.
I
And
think
he
so. Yeah.
he did the cover for my favorite book of all time, which is Maya by Richard Adams,
Oh,
and
okay.
I desperately wanted a print of that illustration. And he said, "Well, I don't do prints really of that old one," but he sent me a JPEG and said, "You just go ahead and print it." And I did, and it's hanging on my wall.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually totally forgot that. Yeah, I totally forgot actually that he did that with the covers and the art and stuff. Yeah. He's definitely one of my, so funny. Like I had interviewed 2 years ago Richard Lee Byers, who's one of my top favorite Forgotten Realms like authors. I would say I said to Richard, I was like, him, and then like Bob and then Elaine Cunningham were three people that I read right away that I was like, I was like 14. I was like, I have to write like a book, like a fantasy book. And I was reading a bunch of their suit like trilogies and standalones and stuff and Forgotten Realms. But then Mel actually was another one right off the bat. And Troy Denning. So like those five people in particular, like really made me want to write after reading their books. And I read all of them like at the same time. So I just started writing just absolute garbage, you know how it is, at that time. So no, much better now. But yeah, so that's really funny though. Yeah, I was actually trying to, Richard was saying like, hey, if you want, and like Tim Pratt was another one that I read recently. with some of his Pathfinder books, and he did some like later Forgotten Realms ones. So I have a couple of those people that I'm in contact with and trying to get on for, if not this season, like season 5, because I always leave a couple slots for guests that I, have admired or, try to get on. And Mel's definitely one of them. So it's funny that you said that. So that's really, really cool. But yeah, I totally forgot about his art. So I'll have to check that out again. But I just have to say, I absolutely love that cover. That, like, I remember when you posted it in particular, I was like, that's really cool. So I was checking out the blurb for the book, and the story. I just thought sounded really, really neat. So I bought that one like right off the bat. And it just goes to show you, right, when they say a book cover, like, don't judge a book by its cover. That's not true, because like 60, I think I saw a statistic 2 years ago, it was like right after the pandemic, like 60% of people do that. And that's like the first thing that they'll notice. And then it's like 30% around, it's like 29, 30% is the blurb. So for me, I feel like that's all the time. I was originally going to be an illustrator. Nobody asked me because I'm really out of practice, but I love art. So for me, like, seeing a really cool cover in particular draws me in because of my background. And if it's, if it's designed really well as well, with the typography, stuff like that, it draws me in even more. And then I go right to the blurb with the reader and writer in me, and then I'll buy that thing. I don't look at reviews. So those are the two things that I look at. I know most people do, but so that one in particular, I just have to say, like really got me. And I was like, I have to own this. So I was so glad that you posted that, because I didn't know that that was one of your books. So I think that that was really smart on your part. And I just was curious with the rebranding too, because I think that that was an excellent job with deciding with the cover, with that artist. So I thought that was really cool.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, for
And I
sure, for sure.
agree. I agree that the cover sells books. I mean, I grew up reading heroic fantasy, and if that isn't just a testament to how a good cover can sell a mediocre book, I don't know what is. Hopefully my book isn't mediocre, though I was doing my best Clark Ashton Smith pastiche with that one. Stylistically, my stuff is very different these days. But yeah, no, the cover is your ambassador. You have to have a good cover. The indie scene is bereft with, I don't want to be mean, but I'll say it anyways, terrible, terrible covers. And that's something indie authors, yeah, we've got to up our game. It can be a little bit expensive, but it is worth it. It is absolutely worth it to get someone who knows what the heck they're doing to do a good cover illustration for you. Also, you need a good editor. That's another conversation. But yeah, that cover needs to grab people's eye immediately. And then, like you said, blurb also important, but the copy on the back of the book, totally secondary in my opinion.
Well, it's interesting because, so my cover artist for my urban fantasy novellas, C.S. Radcliffe, does an amazing job. I liked him, and he's very reasonable. And I've literally tried sending people to him. He did some great jobs for some of my friends as well. And they're like, geez, oh, Pete. It's like, I always tip him because he's like quick, easy, efficient. Listens to you, throws a much better, like whatever you think you're gonna do, he throws something much better. And I had this idea, which I haven't released the other two covers yet, until like my first novella is out. But like, it's cool because we came up with like one, the first one's at sunset, the middle one's at night, and then the third one's at dawn. And it's really cool with, I said this to him from the start. I'm like, I want you to think about this because I know I want this, theme because it matches the character. And he was so great about it. And seeing each of the three side by side, I mean, with the art, with the covers, and already having that story arc plan was just really, really cool. So the few people I showed it to, like Herman Stewart Engel, like Adrian M. Gibson, were like, oh, that's really neat, that it you can kind of see that. So I think that things like that, I totally agree with you. I think it's really important. I think a lot of people too, like, I've seen people pay like $350, which I agree with you, like things that I'm like, why would you even think that? I'm like, is that something you're gonna pick up? That's what I always think. So I totally agree. Those are two things I think, that and the editing, I think are just really, really important. I have like a third round of editing that I don't even mind paying again. I had developmental edits done after my first round of editing did not go so hot. And I just like there were things that the person missed in the same line that they edited. So I was like, I need somebody else. And they didn't do developmental edits like I asked. So I had somebody else, one of my friends, do it. And I just was looking for a reference. She's like, I'm just gonna do it. And she did an amazing job. And that's what I'm currently working on are her amazing notes. So thank you, Sarah Chorn. And yeah, like I would totally pay for a whole nother round of edits from her, like honestly, whatever she wants, because it like has helped my craft like overall. So I agree with you on both those counts. Those are two things I think as indie authors, you just absolutely can't skip. And if you want to be an indie author, I think, you need to find people that, like can help you with that. I would say alpha readers, beta readers is another one too, right? You need a really good team. But yeah, I definitely agree. Those are two things that indie authors cannot skip if we want to, really make the genre ours. And that leads us to our second question here. So what genre or genres do you currently write in and why?
Mostly fantasy because I like fantasy, but I have strayed into science fiction a little bit, just a little bit, and horror, which I took a full step into both with my novella Beware the Little Children, not Beware Little the Children. People don't seem to get my brilliant and genius typographical choices on it. You can see the cover on, I think posted it yesterday. Anyways, that aside, my full-length novel, The Aggregate, that one is full-on cosmic horror and criminal noir, just sort of mushed together into the biggest, fattest book I've ever written. Took me 10 years to do,
Oh,
actually.
wow.
That was one of the comics that I wrote
Oh,
way
cool.
back in the day. And working from my original scripts, went back and just wrote it as a book. But to
Oh,
circle back
cool.
to your actual question before I get too far into the weeds, I love fantasy. Yeah, I've just loved it since I was a kid. And I don't know if there's anything new to say in the fantasy genre, but I can't help writing in it anyways. I just love it so much. So I just try to bring a different perspective to themes that we have all known and enjoyed for so long. I think the genre has become incredibly incestuous over the decades, and I think part of that is due to the massive overpopularity of Tolkien. No shade on Tolkien or Tolkien fans, but I've noticed in my reading that fantasy, starting in like the 1960s, it just started to regurgitate Tolkien. For a while, it was regurgitating Howard. With Conan, you had a million different Conan pastiches out there. Brack the Barbarian by John Jakes being the most egregious, though those can be fun simply because they're so unapologetically trash. Sorry, John. But moving all the way up through the 80s and the 90s, it was just one riff off of Tolkien after another. And so when I came to write my own stuff, I decided I was going to insert my own interests instead of just rehearsing what had been done over and over and over. Yeah, I really like crime fiction, the likes of John D. McDonald. And especially the other the pulp writers from the 1930s, stylistically, they're fantastic. A lot of their plots are just cut and paste, whatever, but the way they write with all those punchy little prose and pithy little sentences, that is just absolutely captivating. So I made the decision, especially with my Vulcan the Returned series, that I was going to write like a pulp writer, but I was going to use themes that were fantasy. So
Oh,
far,
cool.
it's been working.
Well, that's cool. I'm sorry, when you said the aggregate, I was like, the first time that you posted that, I was like, I have to know what this is. So I went and like looked at the blurb right away. And that one in particular like really caught my interest. Because I agree, like I think that there's so many things and people on here, they know I love mashing up of genres or subgenres. Richard Lee Byers again, taking just like your clean typical fantasy and then putting it with horror, and then mixing in some mystery elements as well. Those were why I loved so many of his books in the Forgotten Realms. It wasn't just your typical, you know, there were so many too, where, you know, stories like that where authors where they would come in with different, you know, experience from these subgenres or different genres and they would mash things together. Mel actually had an amazing like heist in the Forgotten Realms setting. So you have the fantasy setting, Forgotten Realms, but he had a heist. And then he had some, I don't want to give it away, some other elements in there too for City of Ravens. And it was one of the best books I've ever read because of that mashup and just the taking of those different elements. So the aggregate in particular, like really stuck out to me for you because I was like, oh, this seems like really up my alley. I wish I had discovered it earlier this year because I had already had a lot of my reading and stuff set. So I'm trying to figure out how to incorporate that into my 2025 reading list because that was one that definitely stuck out to me. But that's really cool. I totally understand too the fantasy. I love sci-fi. I love horror. I love mysteries. But fantasy is really like, I'm glad I discovered fantasy more and more when I got to like middle school because that's more of what I enjoy now. I like to get, you know, this that escapism, I think is, you know, just I like it more than, you know, than even sci-fi now. Unless you're talking about like sci-fi fantasy, I think it's like Star Wars more than, you know, maybe something like Halo or something like that. Cause I am a teacher, I don't want to have to deal with any more real world problems at the end of the day. I want to just escape. Even urban fantasy sometimes I think isn't quite the escape that I need compared to just like a straight fantasy. So I definitely understand that. Now is my favorite thing is to really dive more into your actual books and stories themselves. So I had to start with your welcome books because I think that those just look absolutely amazing. So what are your welcome books about and how did you come up with this idea?
So, good old Vulcan there, and I'm using the Germanic pronunciation, so the W is a V, but you can say it
Cool.
any way you want in your head. It's his name literally means sky. I've got a thing when I name characters, their name needs to match some aspect of their personality, and that. So, you know, there's a necromancer in that story. Her name's Dolora, which is a play on Latin dolorous for sadness, melancholy, pain, that sort of thing. But Velkin is the culmination of all my fantasy writing up until this point, and everything that I've learned about how to craft a story, all the elements that might have cropped up in older works that I have since refined and shoved all into one. There's a lot going on. Though I tried to keep book number one to a very clear and concise linear plot. So you're not going to get flashbacks, you're not going to get tangents. It's just a straightforward noir style story, but told in a fantasy world.
That's cool.
So the book kicks off with Velkin burying a couple of bodies. A couple of dudes kicked in his door the night before and had a go at him. And being a wizard, though, he mopped the floor with them. And he's trying to figure out, as he's burying these two guys, how the heck they got past all of his wards and spells, and who sent them? Why are they here? Because they just came in and had a go at him. So Velkin, being an obsessive, a bit like me, can't leave well enough alone. He decides that he is going to go find out. And that's where book number one kicks off. And Velkin sort of dives head first into a whole heap of troubles and winds up enmeshed in something that he never intended to get enmeshed in. Again, he was supposed to be retired. And he wanted it to stay that way, but nope, The world has a way of just dragging us back in, no matter what we want out of life. So that's, yeah, that's where that one kicks off. I've written three of the books so far. I'm working on number four. Book number two is being edited as we speak.
Oh, cool.
It was supposed to come out this November, but there were some delays, including my editor getting federal jury duty.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, that put a delay on things. So she's working as fast as she can. I'll do a soft release, hopefully end of the month or early December in time for Christmas. But then there'll be another round.
Oh, that's
Another
cool.
round of, yeah.
I say I know all about that pesky release schedule. As
Oh,
I
yeah.
had stuff get same thing, and then I was like, oh, I'm good to go for the spring. And then I was like, this thing is not ready. And then I was like, oh, I think I'm closer. And then Sarah was very nice to be like, nah, you still need, at least like two drafts here, I would say. And I was like, well, I was like, you know more than me. So I was like, sure. So that's like I'm doing draft five right now, which I'm gonna do as like a beta draft. And then send it out and then get that feedback and then make my final, I say, right? Changes and go from there. So I totally understand that. My friend's like, what are you looking at now? Like fall of 28, 2028. I was like, shut up. Like, sometimes those things happen. But that's the nice thing. I just want to point out with indie, right? Like it is really nice to, to be able to do that and, to have that ability. Like you said earlier too, you got to make sure, your cover is great, blurb's great, but I also think, being able to, present a professional product and have time for that production schedules, I like to call it. I want to make sure I have after my betas, right? They have enough time for people to do reviews and then, to send out the final copies and things like that. So I think that, all that's very time consuming and needs to take time, to build up a release. So I think, really learning from, each other really helps, in the process. So, but I just pointing out what you said, like in terms of that getting bumped back, it is good. I think, that you are working on other projects, and things like that at the same time and, not really wasting, that in between production time or release time. So I think that's really smart. So I just want to point that out to the audience too. I always have one thing that I have going that I'm pushing. I have another project that I'm working on to try and get to that point in case something happens with the first one, then I have a fun project. And I got that type of production schedule from somebody that's very, very experienced compared to me. And that he's like, yeah, I do this type of thing all the time. He's a hybrid author, so obviously, he's got to find time in between when editors and, cover artists, things like that can get to things. So I think that's very smart.
Oh yeah,
In terms
stack
of,
them up like planes coming in for a landing.
yeah, exactly. That's a great way to put it. It's a great way to put it. In terms, I'm just curious for that one in particular, for those books though, in terms of his abilities without giving anything away, I'm just curious that, what was like kind of like your main idea for like his abilities or the type of magic, that you wanted to display, within that first book and maybe, just the series in general.
Well, when it comes to magic, especially in fantasy fiction, or modern fantasy fiction, I should say, it's been heavily fetishized, and I think that came out of video games,
Oh, yeah.
honestly, where they had to have a very concrete skill set. Before that, it was Dungeons and Dragons, right? You had to write down what spells you could do so that the game could actually be played. That translated later into video games, but that's where it really took off, especially for general audiences, at least in my observations. And then you get books like The Name of the Wind, where it's so heavily fetishized that I found the book to be unreadable. I'm sorry to any Rothfuss fans out there, but it's just a very subjective thing, and the minutiae of the magic just killed me. It absolutely dragged the story down and brought it to a screeching halt. So when it came to power sets and all that for my characters, I decided to take the approach that Hugh Cooke did. He's a Kiwi author. He sadly died of cancer in the 90s. He wrote a whole series of books, starting with The Wizards and the Warriors, that there was magic in them, but it wasn't so well defined. And as a result, didn't drag on the plot. And I thought that was just a great way to go about things. Now, on the back end, I've had to organize who can do what and why and to what level. But I don't want to put that into the forefront in the series because I think it just grinds things to a halt. So when it comes to characters doing magic, I keep it kind of amorphous so that it serves the purpose of telling the story and doesn't redirect the reader's focus. Belkin, I call him a physiomancer. He does mostly stuff related to physics, and his focus was always hurting people. You know, he's a battle mage, so he didn't stray so much into the realm of flying or mind control or whatever. He just wanted to bash people in the head. So all of his power set is focused there. And sometimes that works to his advantage, sometimes that works to his detriment, and that, adds another level to the storytelling.
That's cool. I like the, I always call it, I call it similar to like the David Eddings approach, with like Belgarion and Belgarath, and Bulgara, where like they're capable of wielding magic. I liked the Malorian in particular, where they, so one of the things that the main character, Belgarion does is to stop two armies. Which he has like allies technically on both sides. He literally is like, "Hey, you guys just need to chill." And when they don't, he essentially creates like this weather phenomenon with like this storm. And then later on, you find out that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And then his grandfather Belgrath comes in with his aunt Bulgaria, and they're like, "Hey, we have literally just spent like the last 2 months riding here, like trying to tamper all the crap that you just did because you created this one storm." And they have to offensive like unofficially like affix the climate within the whole entire like region that they're at. But I always like that because I never really know, I didn't really know in the books like what exactly they were going to do. And he didn't use it as totally blanking today. He didn't use it as a way to save them, right? At any, it's not like they could just do anything at any point. And there were certain restrictions, which I thought were, were well placed, but there were still like a lot of possibilities on what they could do with the magic in particular. So I personally always like something like that. I never know exactly what, going back to Tolkien, I never know exactly what Gandalf's gonna do, but I know he can do some cool stuff. And I don't know, I always like that type of magic system. Sanderson's great, don't get me wrong. I think that type is really cool too, with like Aloe of Law and stuff like that. But I just don't write that way. I don't know. I don't really care about the magic that much. Forgotten Realms, I guess, put that into me. Like, I know people can throw spells and they can do cool stuff with it. And I don't know. Other than that, I don't really care. I will care about the characters and story. And I'm reading fantasy to see those things. If I want to read the, something with science fiction and fantasy where, there's all these different laws and things, I'll read Star Wars or something like that. Where I know that if I do X, Y, and Z, I will fall to closer to the dark side or come back this way or whatever. So I totally, I just agree with you there because I think that that's a smart way to run a magic system. And I agree with you. I think a lot of video games and D&D, particularly like with second to maybe even 3.5 edition, really made people codify their magic system and say that this person can do this and this one can't. A lot of those video games, Diablo 2, those kind of things at that time, World of Warcraft, really centralized magic systems in a different way. But I do think they were also really restrictive as well. So I don't know. I just think that's an interesting take. So I definitely agree with you there. I
Yeah,
didn't
absolutely.
realize that. Yeah, go ahead.
I also like to I know it's sort of become unpopular in recent years to say that I like to ground my fantasy, but I honestly do. The more grounded fantasies are the ones that I like to read, like Glenn Cook's work, the
Oh
Black
man.
Lady.
Oh, I love those books.
Yeah. So when I think of magic, I think of it, or I try to think of it anyways, in a human context, that much like a firearm is a force multiplier, or an F-22 is a force multiplier, you have that with your mages, your wizards, your what have you. And, you know, someone like Velkin, he's a pretty intense force multiplier on, you know, in a battlefield situation where he can act as, in essence, a main battle tank for a unit of soldiers. So he breaks the mold of medieval warfare. You know, when you look at medieval tactics, a lot of the killing happened after formations were broken. You know, you've got two shield walls if you want to use, like, say, Viking style tactics or even hoplite tactics. And these guys are literally just in a scrum pushing against each other to see who can fall apart first. Well, Belkin, he is the factor that makes these formations fall apart, thereby allowing his side to, you know, cut down the dudes on the other side, thereby resolving the conflict. Other mages can be like that F-22, right? Where they are such a force multiplier that they barely even count as human. I don't want to give too much away in
No,
the book. We'll see more of that in book two.
I'm just thinking when you're saying this, I'm thinking this is really, I do agree that the Chronicles of Black Company just awesome. And there are certain individuals in there, right, that do tip, the battles. But in terms of, I always loved it because the Black Company themselves are just a bunch of grunts, right? In a fantasy setting, right? Like a bunch of Marines in a fantasy setting. But I gotta say, like Steven Erikson, even though there are wider magics, I've never seen somebody play with Tolkien, and like really like split that line between hard and soft magics. I read 11 books in the world, 10 of them his, and one of them was Ian Esselmont, and I still don't know how the magic works, entirely, which I'm fine with. But I didn't care, and I loved, but I agree, because like what I loved about it was like it felt like Romanesque like armies with a few of these, mages and their counterparts who, like some of them, like maybe you're like Quick Ben and you're like 10 tanks, right? In the battle, but then maybe I am, maybe one of the other ones that's not as powerful, even Fiddler, sorry, spoilers, where I can do a few things, but it just helps, maybe it's like, just having a machine gun, right? Was it the equivalent? And I liked that there were different levels to magic and who was using them. Bottle's a very good example, I would say, of someone that's in between, and each of them, how he used them in different battles was very similar to what you're saying. I think that's why I enjoyed it more. Because even though I know that Quick Ben can do some crazy stuff, it never really, for him, gets to the point in the army where I would say it's like a nuclear weapon being used. And I liked that because I think that is, like you were saying, like these godlike beings, like there are gods in there, right? And you have some people that are really close to that, but Ben and the actual soldiers, for the Malzans, I like them because they weren't as high powered and they have to figure out ways around some of these, other people and beings. So I think it, the different levels that he had of how they were able to use their magic, really, really added a lot of interesting things into like the battles themselves, and really made you feel for the grunts on the ground. Who are just trying to get by and survive these battles. And he does that right off the bat with Amandor Rake and his side with Gardens of the Moon against the Bridge Burners in particular. So I totally get what you're saying. That's actually why I think I liked the book series in general, because it really made me feel like, even though it was quite different, I would say, than Chronicles of the Black Company, but the Marine aspect and the grunts I really liked. And that's what I always thought was really interesting about Glenn Cook's writing. He really brings you down to that level, right, of the grunts. And maybe some of the other people are doing some of the nuclear weapon style stuff for magic, but it's not them, right? And even some of the mages in their
Right.
company, right? They have a little bit higher powered firearms in terms of their magical ability, but none of them are like bazookas or anything like that. But somehow they're still
Yeah.
able to manage. And I think that made it so much such an interesting story, because he, didn't use it to save anybody, and it's just like a straight up battle the whole time. So yeah, I think that's really cool.
I concur.
He said Wizards and Warriors, and I totally forgot all about that. So I had to start that as a tab so I could go back and check that out again. It's
Yeah,
been a
yeah.
while.
If you can get the British editions of those books, they have fantastic covers. The American editions from Quester were just awful. They never finished the series. So yeah, find the British editions of Hugh Cook's novels.
I think it was, I'm trying to remember if it was like book, I'm trying to remember if I had book one at my parents. I'll have to actually go back up there when I'm there next month and try and pull it out again. But yeah, I remember my cousin was like, here, try this. And I think I must have been in like maybe sixth or seventh grade. And that was like one of the first fantasy books that I just realized that was one of the first fantasy books I ever read. I thought it was like a different genre or something. So as soon as you said that, I looked up the cover. I was like, I remember this now. And so I'm gonna have to go back down memory lane and try the rest. So that's really funny. That's cool
Yeah.
though. And I want to talk about so I want to go back. I know I did it out of order. I don't know. I just thought that that was the series in particular that the first book of yours that I saw you post both in the podcast group and then after on social media. So I just wanted to go with those first. That like drew my eye and I had to go right away and get the book because of the blurb in particular. But I definitely want to go back to the place of Stars and Bones. I'm really interested in how you came up with that concept in particular, because that one to me sounded really, really cool, like right off the bat. That was actually the second one that I saw you post. So I'm just curious about where that concept came from.
So that was, yeah, just me kind of going by the seat of my pants and teaching myself how to tell a longer story. Because before that, I had dabbled in short stories and was writing comic book scripts, and that's very different than writing full prose. The imagery was, yeah, this sounds dumb, but it's true. It's just something that came to me. I couldn't really tell you from whence it came. Maybe that just what I was reading at the time, which was a lot of Clark Ashton Smith, as I mentioned before. If the listeners aren't familiar with Smith, he came out of the pulp novels or the pulp magazines of the 1930s, right along with H.P. Lovecraft and Robert E. Howard. He's the one of that triad that never gets enough love. In my opinion, he could write circles around the other two. Like the dude memorized the dictionary, was a poet laureate by age 19. But anyways, look him up. So it was probably just all the imagery that Smith's work had put into my head and just got put in the blender and then came out my fingers. And it was, I was feeling totally lost at the time. And so the character was feeling totally lost at the time. And as I started to piece myself back together, he started to piece together what was going on in his world. Because it's just this guy, it's told from the first person perspective. I chose not to give him a name. He's supposed to be an everyman, much like in The Pilgrim's Progress. It's thin on plot, but that's the point. It's literally just a road trip novel, A to B to C to D. And we find out along with the character sort of what's going on. It's dribbled out bit by bit by bit. And along the way, he meets these phantasmagoric characters, again, like in The Pilgrim's Progress, where, the protagonist goes from situation to situation, and each situation presents a different character, a different problem to solve, a slightly different environment, but always sort of apocalyptic. And there's that word again, phantasmagorical. I'm going to say that until people get sick of it. But so, a karstic plane on which are scattered bodies, who knows from where, to a wall of bones, 100 feet high that stretches off into the fog as far as you can see, a sea of water that is not water, in which things that are alive but not alive lurk. An abandoned city where the inhabitants sort of melted down and self-destructed and put up monuments to their own depravity and self-destruction, all the way to a living temple that that is malefic in its majesty.
I still love the blurb. I'm going back to it. Just because I thought it was ironic that you said that. Because he's also unable to recall why he's compelled to go on. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. I liked the blurb so much because for me, I think it really felt like very reminiscent of a lot of the oh, how would you say that? Like the dreamlike state of some of the a lot of like the Greek myths, the underworld, or I think they did such a good job it, with Robin Williams and What Dreams May Come and some of those
Oh,
types of scenes. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, just it reminded me, the blurb reminded me of that type of feeling, if that makes sense, with some of these otherworldly like realms. It just put me into that type of state right away. And I don't know, I just think that's really cool because I think it's really hard for people to take you to a place like that, especially with what you're describing, right? And I thought the blurb did a really good job of getting me like interested right away in who is this person? Why is his memory a blank? And it just really made me curious on this stark and desolate plane that he's on. And that's why I have to say, I love the cover itself because I thought it matched so well with the blurb. I saw it and I'm like, okay, see this very interesting, sky with these stars, but this desolate, place full of bones with a character that I can't see their face. Like it just like all three points hit me like right at the same time. And then I went to the blurb and I was like, okay, this is definitely like my kind of book. So I don't know. I thought that the aesthetic there was captured right away between the cover and the blurb in particular. I love those kind of things where you can take me somewhere else and actually like make me feel it and go with the character. I felt like those two things happened right away before even reading a word of the book. So I thought that was really cool.
That's good. That's good. And I'm always pleasantly surprised to see that it still sells, 10 years after I wrote it,
Yeah.
9 years after I publish it. The current edition, the copyright date is a little bit sooner than that. But yeah, I wrote it in the summer of 2014. So, 10 years on, it continues to get traction.
Oh, that's
Even
awesome.
though, as I mentioned before, I write very differently
Yeah,
now.
yeah, yeah. I feel like that's fair. And I just want to make sure because a couple of the other ones that it like grabbed my interest after I kind of did it not for your linear but what I saw on your social media the books that you posted so the next one that I was just curious about or maybe the next three if you don't mind just telling us a little bit about each and that way our audience can kind of peruse themselves but like the three in particular that I thought were most interesting after those ones were Vilis, the Aggregate, which I know you talked about a little bit already, and the Chasm. All three of those seem just like really, really cool, unique ideas. So if you don't mind, just let our audience know, just a little bit about those. That'd be great.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, Villas is one that I wrote under a pseudonym, and published in the relaunch of my, anthology series, Exteris. Unfortunately, that never took off. Sales, have been absolutely abysmal, and I haven't made my money back, which is fantastic. I love that. But, it's just modern audiences don't really want anthologies, I've noticed.
Very, very
That's
hit
just
or
the way the
miss.
market.
Yeah,
They
very,
are.
very
They
hit or
are.
miss. Yep.
That's just the way the marketplace is, and I'm not going to make a value judgment on that. People want what they want, and it's my job as a writer to, well, satisfy myself when I'm writing, but also what my readers want. And so, to that end, Villas is a straightforward fight story. It jumps back and forth between present and past. Vilas, he's an ogre, and he is fighting in an arena, a bit like the Colosseum back in the days of old Rome, but set in a fantasy world. And he's fighting for his life in the present. And then you get a flashback to how he got to that point. And so it's just a straightforward, violent fantasy story, hopefully a crowd pleaser. I was fortunate that the cover illustration on that,
So cool.
when I published it separately, which is, I should mention, actually, before I get too ahead of myself, I'm pulling stories from the old anthologies, so from the original 8 volumes of Exteris and from New Exteris, and I am putting them out as novelettes. Some people call them chap books, but that is a clunky and horrible word, and it feels terrible on my lips, so I call them novelettes. And so, you know, they're only like 30 to 40 pages, so just this little booklet, and I'm selling them for as low as I possibly can. So, like the ebooks are only $1.50, and the paperbacks are $4.29. That's as
Oh, wow.
low a price as I could, because you know the cost of printing is it's expensive. So, you know, I make all of 27 cents, I think, when I sell a paperback. But that's worth it because it makes the books accessible, and that's what I want. I want as many people as possible be able to sink their teeth into them. So I'm doing 11 stories from the old run of Exteris and putting them out as individual novelettes. And Villis is one of the first ones. But people have seemed to vibe with that cover. They like that. It was done by the same guy that did Falcon the Returned, which is a buddy of mine. He calls himself Alex. That's not his real name. He is an angry little man. And he got tired of people giving him crap for using AI elements. Let me stress that, elements in his illustrations. He and I are of the same opinion that AI is a tool. It is not a replacement of artists. It is a tool for artists to use. And so he uses photo montage. He uses digital paint. He uses the AI, and he produces some great works with it. And because AI is such a useful tool, he's inexpensive, so I can afford to do a bunch of these covers. Let's see. Next one you said was the aggregate, correct?
Yeah, that one to me just sounded so cool.
Yes. Yeah. So that one was a comic series that I had done. I wrote all 4 issues of it and was working with an artist, but he and I had a bit of a disagreement over, surprise, surprise, money. That's always the thing. And he dropped off the project and just tanked the series. There is no easier way to kill an indie comic book series than to switch artists midstream. It is like the number one killer of indie comics. And so I hunted around for another artist, and then all my budget fell through, and so I shelved the project. And it wasn't until the summer of 2020 when I got furloughed from work again, another I'm unemployed and have time project, just like Stars and Bones. I just sat down, pulled up the comic book scripts, and used those and worked from them and wrote out the whole thing as a prose novel. And as I wrote, it grew, and I was able to put in more characterization than I otherwise would have with a comic book series. Much like with television and movies, comic books need to be, unless we're talking Japanese manga, they need to be snapshots, little scenes that you know, just encapsulate the necessary information. With prose, you can expand on that, right? You can have subplots, you can have you can build on all the little nuances of the individual characters. And so that's what I did. And the book turned out to be a doorstop, you know, not a Brandon Sanderson sized doorstop, but it's still pretty heavy, hefty. And I recently put out a special edition of that with a different cover. I went with a Chinese illustrator. I'm going to mispronounce his name, and I apologize. Zhang Wei is the best my foolish tongue can manage. And he did a comic book style illustration, so it sort of harkens back to the original project. And I published the script for the very first issue with all of its
Oh,
sharp corners and misspellings and grammatical errors in
that's
it. But that one, that was a mashup of, as I mentioned, noir, which is a theme I keep coming back to, and cosmic horror. And that made for some very interesting interactions.
That's awesome. I think it's funny because I had the same issue. I always wanted to do a graphic novel, and at the time, back in the day, I wanted to be the artist, and then I was like, I just want to write. I had this Diablo-like story in my head of this blacksmith and his thief friend. They used to be like in the same army, and there's like a healer, so she's like the sorceress or whatever you want to say, the magic user, and she becomes a healer in the town. And I always thought of Diablo 2 or Diablo where there's like the Griswold, the Smith, or whatever, and you have to go get his like hammer. So I thought, well, what if Griswold was in the first game? He was actually a really cool character. And he helps you at one point. He's like, yeah, I'm gonna go get this kid from the dungeon or whatever. And I thought, oh, that's just a cool concept. And that always stuck in my head. So I was like, I want to do this as a graphic novel. So before the pandemic, I had a local friend who's an amazing black and white artist. He just does amazing inks. And I talked to him, was like, hey, what do you think about this? He goes, oh my God, I loved that story. So I had like, notes and everything. And then the pandemic happened. So good or bad, we didn't do it. So a while, like last year for NaNoWriMo, I was like, I just needed a new outline because I was like, needed something. So I took a lot of those old notes and I re-outlined everything. Like you said, added, more plot. I guess more plot, right? Because I had some other things I could do then with the wordage and then a lot of subplots, characterization and stuff, and came up with a whole new outline for a different book. So I'm definitely repurposing that story for my Ties That Bind series. So I definitely know that feeling of that kind of project being shifted for sure. So it definitely gets interesting. But that one to me always sounds really cool because I like that it's the criminal noir and cosmic horror combined. So I thought that like always sounded really cool. And to me, like another one that really caught my eye for you was The Chasm in particular. So do you mind just kind of explaining that one just real quick for our audience? That one just always sounds
Oh,
neat.
sure. Yeah, that one was just a meditation on the nature of change. I went heavy into the allegory on that. So we've got one character named Variastes,
So cool.
and he is sort of change incarnate. He's I set this all on an alien world, so there's no people in it. Everything is just kind of off the wall. And his specialty is that he can change himself, so he can. He grows a new lobe for his brain. He grows an eye in the back of his head, and he's always moving from place to place. He's never stationary. He wants to see everything and experience everything. And I put him up against a creature called Adamantus. They just literally run into each other by happenstance. And Adamantus, he is the embodiment of non-change. The stationary, the static, and Adamantus hates the world because it keeps changing, and he doesn't want it to change. He wants it to be the way it was. He's very, very old. He was around when the planet formed, and he's just seen it continue to change, and it just bothers him to no end. And so when he runs up against this wizard, who is sort of just the embodiment of change, there's a tense conversation to be had, and I won't spoil the ending, but it was a lot of fun to write, to use these characters as direct allegories for things we deal with from day to day, right? We want to preserve, say, things from our childhood, right? We want to be able to sit down in front of the TV at 3 o'clock and watch Masters of the Universe and eat cookies, and everything is great. But that's just not the way life is, and it was an interesting headspace to get into, and a fun story to write. So it was, Yeah, I mean, not everyone's going to vibe with that. Not everyone likes allegory and metaphor and blah, blah, blah. But that's all right. I write plenty of other stuff too.
That's fair. I feel like I love some of those classical themes. Again, going back, classical literature. I don't know. I think some of those themes are really, really cool. So that one to me, just always stuck out of yours. So I think that's a really cool one. I know we're running out of time, so I just want to make sure that we have enough time for that last question. Before we get there, I just have to know, because you've written a lot of different things, a lot of different characters. Who is one character that you are really proud of writing and why?
Oh gosh.
Pick your favorite
Oh,
child.
gotta choose between my children exactly where I
Or
was going.
it could be two, three. I'm just curious, just so our audience knows, in particular, like which ones, have really stuck out for you, because I think those always, really tend to stick out for audiences as well. So.
Right. I really enjoyed writing Delora from The Valkyrie Returned. She's the necromancer. She shows up much more in book two than in book one. You just get a glimpse of her in book one,
Oh, cool.
but she is just so much fun to write because she is all id. All she wants to do is what she wants to do, and there are very few filters on her. So she is going to cause mayhem and havoc simply because she wants to. And it was great to liberate myself because. I tend to put a lot of restrictions on myself and whatever I'm doing. When it comes to writing, I've got these rules, things that I'm not going to do, whether that's mechanics or themes or you name it. And so to be able to write a character who's pretty diametrically opposed to who I am is kind of liberating because through her as a proxy, I can go a little bit wild. Though Velkin is also pretty great because he's sort of steering the ship, and I can get him to say all sorts of fun stuff. And because he's a wee bit of a bastard, he can say things that are impolite that me, a real person in polite society, cannot say.
I feel like that's fair. I totally get that. My main my monster hunter, who's one of my he's like a co-lead for my Nathaniel Wither Monster Hunter series, is named after him, but there's a lot of other people involved, and he's very Jack Reacherish, and he's very like I say, like Justin Hartley, like from The Tracker, like very matter of fact, is like particularly with bad guys, like you need to get out of my way. If you don't, I'm going to make you get out of my way. And my wife, she's like, "Well, you're not like that character." I go, "I want to be like that character." I'm like, always think of Arnold Schwarzenegger from Kindergarten Cop, where he's has a situation with a young student who is being physically abused by a parent, and he confronts the dad, and the principal later is like, "You didn't have to hit him." He's like, "Well, he tried to hit me first, and he hit the kid." And I'm like, I get that. Like, I have dealt with a lot of things in my job where I'm like, God, I wish I could be Arnold Schwarzenegger right now in Kindergarten Cop. And I can't, though, right? Because of societal norms. And even though somebody might agree with me, somebody would sue me. And I put that into my writing instead, right? So I told my wife, I'm like, Nathaniel is the person that I wish I could be, because he's needed in a lot of, I think, a lot of situations, right? But in a real world, he would definitely be in prison or something, and he's a monster hunter, right? Right? Yeah. So he's like on the outskirts of society and stuff. And, so I totally get that. I think it's fun to explore those people who are opposite you or maybe have some characteristics. And I think writing is just a good, healthy way to, come to a interesting medium, right? To tell a story, but also to, show different aspects of, your character or personality mixed with some other ones. And yeah, I think you always get some interesting stuff. So I definitely understand that. I think that's super cool. So that's really neat. I know we're running out of time here, so I just want to make sure that you had enough time to tell us any of the news updates, or are there any current projects that you can share with us?
Absolutely. They're the aforementioned novelettes. I've got 11 of those coming out,
Oh,
some
sweet.
by me, some by other authors. I'll keep posting them in your blog space and
Awesome.
in mine as well. And the second novel of the Velkin series is going to be entitled Velkin the Embattled. It's more of a military fantasy. While the
Oh,
first
cool.
one was straight up noir, this one is focuses much more on a clash of armies.
Oh,
And
cool.
yeah, so hopefully end of November, early December. So by the time this airs, it ought to be out. Fingers crossed.
Back I would.
You're right. Yeah. And yeah, those are the big announcements. So very inexpensive novelettes. Go get all of those. And Velkin the Embattled.
Awesome. Well, I just want to remind everybody that G. Owen Wares's links can be found in the description anywhere where you're listening to this interview or watching it. We just want to make sure too that we're really doing a really good job of reviewing products anywhere where they're found. You've done a great job mentioning your artists and different people involved in your process. So please make sure it's not just the authors and creatives that we have on here. It's the other people as well that usually don't get named. I talk about Sarah a lot. She's helped me out a great deal. My alpha readers, Logan D. Irons, H.L. Tinsley, don't get paid, right? Except for free books and swag and stuff. There's plenty of people that are helping in our processes. So, helping us out with reviews just allows us to get those people the work that they do, and that we need them to do in order to get the products that you guys enjoy. So I just want to keep reminding our audience the last two seasons, that's really been, our big push. So please make sure you're doing that. Thank you so much for coming on today. Again, thank you so much in the group, for just, keep posting great content, sharing stories, and updates. So I definitely appreciate that. But if there's anything else I can do, per usual, you can, find me on Facebook, in the group itself, or just email me and we'll get everything out there, to the best of our abilities on all the social media platforms, and just keep doing what you're doing. It sounds awesome, and I've already bought a lot of cool stuff for you, and can't wait to start reviewing. But yeah, other than that, I hope you have a great rest of the day. But if there's anything else I can do, just message me, and we'll get it done to the best of our ability. So.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for taking your time to talk
Yeah, of
with
course.
me about what I do, and let me continue to post in your group. It's invaluable for little guys like me to be able
Yeah.
to post up and expand my readership. So thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said, to our audience, if anybody wants to join us, the podcast group that we're talking about on Facebook is always in the description. So if you want to come and you're a reader, you want to check out, anybody's works, or you're, a creative and you want to come and post something, feel free. If you're not sure about what you can do, just let me know and message me, or, leave a comment and I'll let you know. But come and join us. We have a pretty good time sharing everybody's stuff. So it's fun. But I hope you have a great rest of the day, my friend. And I'm sure I'll see you, in the Facebook group over the next couple of days. I'll send you a follow-up email and we'll get this all situated and we'll be all set. So.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah, not a problem. You have a good rest of the day, my friend, and I will talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.
See you.